Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming out tonight, folks, and the lead up to Easter. It's good to see you all here, and Senator Simon Birmingham makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. He'll be known to you, but I'll introduce him briefly. Senator Birmingham has got an MBA from the University of Adelaide. He worked on the staff of Robert Hill, the minister, of course, in the Howard government. He also worked for South Australian ministers and also for Industry Association and for a number of years with the Winemakers Federation. In 2007, Simon Birmingham was elected to the Senate in filled a casual vacancy in the Senate, and he's subsequently been re-elected, most recently in the 2013 election. So it's great to have Senator Birmingham here, who has a role currently as the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister for the Environment, and he's going to speak to us tonight on enabling efficient and effective environmental management. Simon Birmingham, be very welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, for that welcome. It's wonderful to be here tonight on another quiet day in the politics of Australia's first state. As the member of the executive of the Commonwealth Government with responsibility for water issues, it's with some trepidation that I enter Sydney at present, but I am very pleased and grateful for the opportunity to be here at the Sydney Institute tonight. I want to start by paying a particular tribute to Jared and Anne Henderson and the small but very hard-working and effective team at the Sydney Institute who provide this premier platform for public policy debate and discussion in Australia. As Jared indicated, tonight I want to particularly tackle the issues as I perceive them of enabling effective and efficient environmental management in Australia. The modern-day environmental debate is all too often presented as a crude choice between the environment and the economy. However, as those of both liberal and conservative persuasion appreciate, the two are mutually codependent. A well-managed environment sustains our economy, just as a successful economy underpins the conservation of our environment. Long recognised in debates about environmental sustainability is the importance of the intergenerational legacy we leave. The great conservationist and former Republican President Theodore Roosevelt highlighted this in his 1907 Arbor Day message to the schoolchildren of the United States, in which he said, and I quote, "We of an elder generation can get along with what we have, though with growing hardship, but in your full manhood and womanhood, you will want what nature once so bountifully supplied and man so thoughtlessly destroyed. And because of that want, you will reproach us, not for what we have used, but for what we have wasted, which in its youth lives only for the day. Any nation which in its youth lives only for the day reaps without sowing and consumes without husbanding must expect the penalty of the prodigal whose labour could with difficulty find him the bare means of life." Not only is this prose, no doubt delivered by Roosevelt more elegantly than I, testament to the conservationist instincts of Roosevelt, who did much to expand the national park system and preserve the natural and cultural heritage of the United States, but the wonderful language in what was a message to schoolchildren is a great credit to the educational aspirations of the era too. A couple of generations later, across the Atlantic, another world leader delivered the same message, albeit in simpler and more market-oriented terms. Said Margaret Thatcher in 1988, No generation has a freehold on this earth. All we have is a life tenancy with full repairing lease. As we aspire to deliver successful economic and environmental codependence for the modern era, the Abbott government inherits the views of those who went before us, like Roosevelt and Thatcher, as well as our own domestic predecessors, such as the McMahon government, who appointed Australia's first federal environment minister. In Tony Abbott, we have a Prime Minister who has long recognised the importance of sound environmental stewardship. Looking through the lens of his own life, he told the Sydney Institute in 2010 that, as a child exploring the bushland near the family home, a teenager canoeing down New South Wales's coastal rivers, a student trekking through the wilderness to Sydney's west, or these days, as a surfer and volunteer firefighter, I've always had a strong consciousness of environmental values and an appreciation of the need to protect the one planet that we have to live on. Tony put those words into practice as local member of parliament in helping to drive the preservation of iconic sites around Sydney Harbour through the establishment of the innovative and now self-funding Sydney Harbour Federation Trust. He did likewise as a young parliamentary secretary, establishing the Green Corps to give thousands of young Australians an opportunity to make a practical contribution to the improvement of our natural environment. And of course, today, Tony Abbott oversees a government that continues to give practical focus to environmental management, which recognises its duty to do what we can to ensure our natural environment is successfully passed to the next generation, just as we equally seek to pass on the best of economic opportunities and living standards. Our government has a vision for a stronger Australia, an Australia that is more competitive, more productive, and better equipped to deal with both expected and unexpected change. Our ambition is for business to prosper, communities to thrive, and the unique and iconic aspects of our natural environment to be protected for future generations. This evening, my comments will focus on the three tests that should be applied to environmental policy in Australia: that it be enabling, efficient, and effective. Firstly, environmental policy must enable, not stymie, economic activity. That is not to say that it should give a green light to anything and everything, but that it must not be seen as an automatic impediment or roadblock to progress. Secondly, environmental management must be efficient. It must come at the lowest cost to taxpayers, businesses, and the community. And we must be conscious that cost is measured not just in direct outlays, but also in lost time, lost opportunity, and social impacts. Finally, and very importantly, worthwhile environmental management must be effective. It should deliver what it was intended to achieve. If something is really worth protecting, then it is worth protecting properly. These three tests may seem simple, but too often they have been forgotten, overlooked, or neglected in the development of our environmental policy settings. While they are relevant to all areas of environmental policy development, tonight I will focus on their application to issues of sustainable water allocations, emissions reductions, and the protection of landscapes and biodiversity. Water reform in Australia is driven first and foremost by the imperative to ensure there is enough fit-for-purpose water available for use now and in a world where rainfall patterns and inflows are highly variable and unpredictable. First and foremost, our duty is to secure water for critical human needs. But water is so much more than a basic requirement for life. It is also an essential input into economic production and a foundation of ecosystems. We demand water for human needs, agricultural needs, industrial needs, and environmental needs. When the availability of water fails, so does the production of many crops. When the price of water rises, so does the price of the goods in which it is an input cost. And when we use too much, we threaten the future quality of water in our rivers or availability of water in our aquifers. The correlation between water as an input and final economic output is most directly seen in irrigated agriculture. While less than 1% of Australia's agricultural land is irrigated, production from irrigated agriculture constituted 29% of the total gross value of agricultural production in 2011-12, generating some $13.5 billion. However, the supply of water is also essential for countless other areas of production, from the making of medicines to the refining of precious metals. Without question, the availability of reliable, affordable, and good quality water is an essential enabler of economic activity. This economic imperative, coupled with rapidly emerging issues of water scarcity during the millennium drought, and a fear that we may be doing long-lasting damage to our water resources, sparked the current wave of water reform that we continue to ride today. On June 25 this year, Australia will celebrate the 10th anniversary of the signing of the National Water Initiative. This agreement with the states, secured by the Howard government, has underpinned investment and trade in water markets in Australia. The NWI has paved the way for water efficiency and water-related investment that benefits us all. Extending standard economic and sustainability principles to water pricing, planning, and allocation has helped to give water a price that reflects its true value. Under the NWI, states are implementing comprehensive water plans, catchment by catchment, that account for wide-ranging environmental, community, and business considerations. A clear definition of water rights has enabled the legal security of entitlements to water as distinct from land. The development of water markets, operating within caps that set sustainable limits on the use of surface water and groundwater, is now delivering more efficient allocation of this scarce resource, enabling greater productivity from its use, and providing more effective protection for our rivers and water storages. Efficiently operating markets come into their own in times of scarcity, where a limited resource should flow to the highest value outcomes. This was the case during the millennium drought. Many horticultural farming operations were able to keep permanent plantings alive to preserve investments that had taken many years to establish through the purchase of water allocation from farmers of annual crops, who earned much-needed income from this trade. At the height of drought, when incomes were diminishing and debt levels rising, it didn't feel like much of a win. But imagine how much worse it would have been if effective trading had not been allowed and rights to use water had been stranded in locations where it was unable to be most efficiently utilised. Not only did market principles help to reduce financial pain for many farmers, but they also helped to maintain the value of agricultural production during the drought. From 2005-06 to 2007-08, the combination of trading, enhanced efficiencies and scarcity saw the amount of water used by irrigators fall by 57%, yet the value of irrigated production fall by only 8%. The principles and requirements of the NWI also provided the basis for the Howard government's Water Act of 2007, which sought to address an overallocation of water resources in our largest and most productive catchment, the Murray-Darling Basin. Without acceptance of sound market principles, the pathway to return the Murray-Darling to sustainable levels of extraction would have been difficult to accomplish and would have resulted in poorer outcomes. While the interaction of the NWI, Water Act, and Murray-Darling Basin Plan is enabling economic development, ensuring efficient allocation of resources, and giving effective protection to our riverine and groundwater ecosystems, the failure to do so in the first place has come at high cost to taxpayers and river communities. Some 2,750 billion litres of water entitlements are being recovered to bridge the gap between previously unsustainable levels of extraction and new sustainable diversion limits. This is not the fault of farmers or communities, but of previous state governments who facilitated the overallocation in the first place. The economic and social costs of the adjustment to new limits are significant. To ensure we achieve maximum productivity under the new limits, our government is focusing investment in water-efficient infrastructure as our primary means of bridging that gap. Almost $7 billion in measures to make irrigation farms more efficient, irrigation systems more efficient, and the delivery of environmental water more efficient are or will be undertaken. The total cost to taxpayers of rectifying previously ineffective and inefficient management of water will ultimately reach around $12 billion. It is a salutary lesson in the costs of poor environmental policy, and an important lesson for us to remember as we embark upon considerations of northern development in the future. While Australia has, thanks to the commitment of successive governments, successfully reformed the management of water through a functioning market that best enables optimum economic outcomes, the same cannot be said of the approach to emissions reduction. The advent of the carbon tax saw a policy that fails all three tests for sound environmental policy. Far from enabling development, the carbon tax is a multi-billion dollar impost on Australian economy and the competitiveness of Australian businesses, stripping some $7.6 billion out of businesses last year and forecast to rise. The carbon tax makes the attractiveness of investment in Australia less so and reduces the financial capacity of Australian businesses to invest in being more carbon efficient. The carbon tax strangles investment and development rather than enabling and encouraging it. With a Treasury estimated cost of living impact of $550 for every Australian household in 2014-15, the effects of the tax reach every corner of Australia. It also fails the test of being efficient. In addition to the whopping tax bill, there are enormous red tape costs, with the regulation impact statement undertaken for the carbon tax repeal bills estimating a reduction in compliance costs to business of $85.3 million per annum from its abolition. That's a benefit to business if we can get the repeal through. The inefficiencies of Labor's carbon tax regime are exemplified by the bloating of the public service through the creation of a cavalcade of quangos and bureaucratic acronyms. Around $400 million of expenditure associated with the public service costs of just implementing the carbon tax was budgeted by the previous government. The final inefficiency created by the carbon tax is the distortionary behaviour it incentivises. The complex maze of incentives, exemptions, rebates and grants created is a magnet for the worst of rent-seeking behaviour. The incentives for business to get more of their business processes accepted under the activity definitions for emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries are far, far greater than the incentives to actually reduce emissions levels. In fact, the carbon tax has already been proven to be singularly ineffective at reducing emissions. A recent update of Australia's national greenhouse gas inventory shows that for the first year of the carbon tax, overall emissions fell by just 0.1%. Even under Labor's modelling of the carbon tax, Australia's domestic emissions are projected to go up, not down, in the period to 2020. The lack of effectiveness in reducing our emissions is made worse by the likelihood that, left intact, the carbon tax will drive carbon leakage from the Australian economy into competitor nations who are without similarly punitive arrangements. Given the global nature of the emissions problem, this reality is perhaps the greatest example of the ineffectiveness of the regime. A real-life example of the failings of the carbon tax is South Australian company Penrice Soda Products, which last Friday announced it was entering into voluntary administration. Penrice was a company already struggling to compete, but more than $3 million in carbon tax-related fees, charges and penalties added to their woes and has made their survival that much harder. As one of these smaller liable entities, Penrice struggled not just with their carbon tax bill, but with the complexities of compliance. To reduce their carbon tax costs, they even shut down the domestic production of soda ash, only to import the good instead. We will repeal the punitive carbon tax, whether or not Labor heed the latest wake-up call given by voters in WA. In its place, we will meet the bipartisan emissions reduction target through a policy that does enable investment, is efficient to operate, and will effectively reduce emissions. Our emissions reduction fund reduces costs for businesses, households and government, yet will result in genuinely verifiable emissions reductions. It is a simple and transparent market-based solution that will reward innovation and enable Australia to play its part in tackling this problem. The Emissions Reduction Fund targets low-cost abatement by providing an incentive to reduce emissions. This incentive-based approach enables and encourages investment by Australian businesses in the transformation of their enterprises to lower levels of emissions intensity. Our approach is more efficient in that it targets investment purely to the lowest cost means of emissions abatement, rather than just taxing the vast majority of emissions in the hope of reducing their scale. This efficient targeting occurs via the creation of a market for abatement, in the same way that both Labor and Coalition governments have used tender processes to purchase water entitlements in recent years. By utilising an auction process, we will establish a cost curve and market value for abatement, which allows the government to minimise its cost while achieving verifiable reductions. Because verifiable abatement actions are contracted to the government, we will know how, when and where emissions will occur, emissions reductions occur. All Australians will be able to assess the effectiveness of the fund because they will be able to see where the emissions reductions have occurred and at what cost they have been realised. Late last year, we released a green paper setting out design options for the Emissions Reduction Fund. In coming weeks, we will be releasing the Emissions Reduction Fund white paper outlining the final detail and design of the fund. A real-world contrast to the impact of the carbon tax on a company like Penrice is the transformative impact the Emissions Reduction Fund can have by helping businesses reduce costs and emissions, as companies like Linfox have already demonstrated is possible. As one of Australia's largest transport and logistics companies, Linfox reduced their energy costs and cut emissions intensity by 37% through improved practices, technologies and staff behaviour. This is exactly the sort of opportunity we want the fund to unlock, where they are additional to normal business practice. While fixing policy failures in water allocations are well advanced and plans to implement better policies for emissions reductions are being implemented, there is still much to be done to ensure policies and laws in landscape and biodiversity protection are enabling efficient and effective. Over the last few decades, we have seen a rapid growth in state and federal environmental laws and regulations. While nearly all are well-intentioned, they have created a complex framework for environmental analysis, assessments and approvals that we have committed to simplifying. Our government has already demonstrated our determination to cut $1 billion every year in red tape and green tape costs. This will improve our competitiveness, help to create more jobs and lower household costs. The intent of our deregulation agenda is not to reduce the quality of the protections of environmental law. Rather, it is to recognise that regulation doesn't always solve complex policy problems, but it does add to the bureaucratic burden on business and society. We must focus on the effectiveness of environmental regulation, not simply the scope and scale of it. The Environment Portfolio was an active contributor to the first Parliamentary Repeal Day. Streamlining amendments were debated for three acts and 866 spent or redundant legislative instruments administered by the portfolio were repealed. We will build on this initial work via an audit of all regulation across the Environment Portfolio to determine the cost imposed to individuals, business and not-for-profit organisations. The Department of Environment will work closely with stakeholders and key bodies to seek feedback about how the portfolio can simplify complex, cumbersome and costly regulation. Shortly, I will announce the final terms of reference and membership of a panel to review the Water Act, with a key focus on reducing red tape or compliance costs and improving productivity outcomes for water users without in any way reducing the effectiveness of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. Already underway, our election commitment to a one-stop shop for environmental assessments and approvals is a key reform to reduce compliance costs for stakeholders while continuing to achieve good environmental outcomes. The overlap and duplication of similar regulatory processes is an obvious source of unnecessary burden for proponents of major projects. Our one-stop shop policy aims to minimise the bureaucratic process so that businesses don't have to jump over the same hurdle multiple times. It will make the process of environmental assessments and approvals more enabling and more efficient by reducing the economic impact associated with delays. Lost time can act as a disincentive to invest, regardless of whether or not approval would ultimately have been granted. The Productivity Commission has estimated that the cost of a one-year delay to an average major project is in the order of $26 to $59 million per project, while for a major offshore LNG project, a one-year delay could have an impact up to $2 billion. In a submission to COAG, the Business Council noted that obtaining approvals for one major project had cost $25 million and involved 4,000 meetings, briefings and presentations, as well as the preparation of a 12,000-page report. After 2 years, 1,200 state and 300 Commonwealth conditions were imposed, with a further 8,000 sub-conditions. According to industry estimates, the average Australian thermal coal project is now delayed by an additional 1.3 years relative to projects in competitor countries. In Australia, it takes an estimated 3.1 years to complete assessment and approvals, compared with 1.8 years internationally. Pleasingly, Environment Minister Greg Hunt has moved to quickly clear a backlog of decisions under the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, with 52 final approval decisions in his first 6 months in office, representing more than $479 billion in economic value. Under our one-stop-shop policy, state environmental assessment and approval systems will be accredited under national environment law to create an approval process that satisfies both state and Commonwealth requirements. Making the process more streamlined means reducing the timeframes for making decisions. A three-stage process is being used to deliver the one-stop-shop policy with each willing jurisdiction. Firstly, the signing of a memorandum of understanding on the key principles and confirming their cooperation to achieve a single process. Secondly, the streamlining of assessments, including updating existing assessment bilateral agreements with states and territories. And finally, negotiating new bilateral agreements for environmental approvals by those states and territories. Thanks to the outstanding work of Minister Hunt and the Environment Department, our government has already signed memoranda of understanding with all jurisdictions and has settled agreements to streamline assessments with a number of states. These agreements substantially broaden the range of matters of national environmental significance that only require a single assessment report and commit to a more cooperative approach to protecting the environment. The next stage of the reform is to negotiate and agree on approval agreements with willing states, providing for the final removal of the duplicative processes. This reform will represent the most significant reduction in green tape Australia has seen, without diminution of environmental standards. But the work should not stop there. As evidenced by the examples I've given, the scale of environmental impact statements, assessments, and approval conditions is often immense. However, environmental assessments that resemble several volumes of phone books and conditional approvals that rival tax laws for complexity are no guarantee of optimal environmental outcomes. In fact, the extent of complexity presents its own challenges in terms of the best utilisation of assessment information and the proper enforcement of approval conditions. As implementation of the one-stop-shop reforms proceeds, the next wave of reform we need to contemplate should focus on how we can make assessments and approvals both more efficient and more effective. In no way should this mean that we diminish the use of the best scientific information or lower our standards for the protection of matters of national environmental significance. To the contrary, we should strive for a system where more efficient application of our laws not only enables swifter approvals of complying developments, but also leads to more effective protection of listed species and habitats. After all, the effectiveness of current frameworks should rightly be questioned when the number and severity of endangered species listings has continued to rise despite the increasing level of regulation. Work on the next wave of reforms is already underway. Minister Hunt has already referred a review of all environmental legislation and regulation to the House of Representatives Environment Committee, while the Commonwealth has commenced discussions with states and territories to identify unworkable, contradictory, or incompatible environmental regulation. opportunities for multi-jurisdictional reform to simplify, streamline, or harmonise environmental regulation, whilst enhancing its outcomes and effectiveness, should be seized wherever possible. To sum up, the protection of the environment and pursuit of economic growth are not mutually exclusive objectives, but rather two essential elements of a single goal, a stronger Australia. We cannot sustain economic growth without clean air, safe and reliable water supplies, and access to natural resources. Our policies are underpinned by this simple truth. A strong economy ensures we will be able to continue to deliver the services to people and offer the protections to our environment that Australians rightly want and expect. By pursuing environmental policies that are enabling, efficient and effective, we can deliver our vision of Australia that is productive, innovative and forward-looking, while, to paraphrase Margaret Thatcher, passing on the tenancy of our nation to future generations with full repair. Thank you very much for your time this evening, and I look forward to your questions.
So many thanks, Senator Birmingham. Just before we go to questions and discussion, thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions. It's been a historic day in New South Wales, as you are aware, and for many a sad day, which has seen the resignation of Premier Barry O'Farrell. But as someone who's a parliamentary secretary to the Minister for the Environment, with a special responsibility for water, but also a South Australian senator, how have your negotiations been with the various states, Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland, which impact on what you're trying to do both as a senator in South Australia and as a parliamentary secretary to the minister?
Thanks, Gerard. In terms of negotiations with those Murray-Darling Basin states, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Queensland and the ACT, I'm very pleased that in our time in office we have managed to secure the signature now of all states on the intergovernmental agreement to implement the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. Queensland and New South Wales had resisted doing so previously, and it took some policy commitments from us to get them over the line, namely and particularly committing to cap the level of buybacks of entitlement across the basin and give priority, as I said in my speech, to infrastructure investments as a primary means of bridging the remaining gap to the sustainable diversion limits that have been set. So I'm pleased now to have a level of cooperation from all of the states, and all do appear to be working cooperatively and harmoniously on this policy. If I can at least reflect fleetingly on the day's events as well, and that is that Barry O'Farrell, in all of my dealings with him over the years, from our days in opposition and his days in opposition, through, of course, to the time in government, is a man of honour and integrity, and I think that is how he has demonstrated his actions today by instantly stepping aside the moment he realised that he had given incorrect evidence to the ICAC. It is a terrible thing to see a leader struck down like he has been, a leader who I think was really now fully in his stride in terms of delivering effective government for New South Wales. And I hope and have faith that whoever replaces him from within the deep ranks of the New South Wales Liberal Party will be able to continue that work. But that makes it no less a personal and political tragedy to see somebody of Barry's honour, calibre and work ethic suffer a fate like he has today. But I guess, as they say, that's politics.
So, yes, question?
Hi. Can you give us an update as to how the department's going with the environmental watering plans under the Murray-Darling Basin plan?
So I've been quite pleased with progress there, and I'm conscious not everybody understands, of course, the detail to the same extent as you do, Jenny, in relation to how the Basin Plan is structured. It has a chapter that deals with broad environmental objectives. Within that, then, we have a statutory office holder, the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder, who ultimately undertakes the very specific watering actions and also in conjunction with the MDBA sets an annual strategy and what will become now a longer-term strategy as well, indicating the outcomes he wants from the water that the Commonwealth has recovered for environmental purposes. I, just last week, travelled through southern New South Wales, Deniliquin, Griffith, Balranald, talking to locals there about how things were going, and they gave some very positive feedback in terms of the way decisions around environmental watering are being taken, as well as, I think, a stronger sense that they're now starting to see from the environmental water holder some longer-term planning. Now, there are some other steps that need to be taken over the next couple of years in terms of making sure that everyone has a relatively clear picture of how environmental water will be used, but of course its uses will vary from year to year dependent upon climatic conditions. And so the idea that we'll necessarily end up with an environmental watering plan that gives a very precise several years out outlook of what will be undertaken is wrong. What we'll end up with are environmental watering plans that give indications of what the objectives are, what the plans are, but those plans will then be subject on a fairly regular basis to change, dependent upon, of course, on how rivers are flowing and how much it's raining and all of those logical things that that people would anticipate. But to date, I'm very pleased that there seems to be a change in outlook from irrigation communities to working with in the environmental water holder, and that I think is a testament to the fact that he has given a very changed outlook to working with those irrigation communities on optimal outcomes, including, of course, commencing some level of trade of his own allocations for better environmental outcomes that have also lent themselves to better economic outcomes.
Dennis.
Senator. CSIRO and the Met Bureau provided significant advice over the years to the Environment Department. Looking forward, in terms of funding those agencies for government to draw on that advice, where do you see their budgets going and the capacity of those agencies to provide you with advice that you need to make technical assessments?
We're obviously going through a very difficult budget process. That's no secret to anybody, and there's been plenty of coverage around some of the challenges that the CSIRO's budget have faced, and the Bureau of Med is part of my portfolio responsibilities, so I'm well aware of some of the budgetary challenges we have for them as well. What I think as a government we are seeking to do across the board is ensure that government services and agencies are very much focused and prioritised on their core service outputs and on delivering, of course, the government's priorities and promises. And so when it comes to agencies, and I'll speak particularly like about the Bureau, because it's part of my portfolio responsibilities, I'm confident that we will have the funding profile for the Bureau that allows them to provide Australia with some of the best forecasting services in the world and some of the best climatic research capabilities in the world, and making sure that into the future they are providing the same quality of services, but improving as technology and knowledge and research allows them to over the years to come. I'm sure with CSIRO the same will happen. Of course, CSIRO, like any other agency that perhaps, for an example, the Health and Medical Research Council or any others, its volume of research projects or work will, of course, ultimately be impacted to some extent by the budget that it is accorded in a given year. But I think in terms of focusing on the priorities, I'm sure the portfolio that CSIRO reports into will be ensuring that they're focused on the outcomes that are most important to Australia and the research that is most important to Australia's wellbeing within whatever the final budget scope is. But certainly both institutions are valued. Both institutions have been cited on a regular basis by Minister Hunt as being really his core advisers when it comes to climate issues, and they're valued, of course, across government for a range of other services they provide.
There's a question here.
Yeah, we've seen a significant infrastructure announcement today from the federal government, as you know they're aware, and related to that is another sort of infrastructure we seem to shy away from in this country, and that's nuclear power. Has there been any consideration likely to be in this current period of government to building nuclear power as an alternative to coal?
So I think the first reference you're making is to road development.
No, right? The airport, I'm sorry.
And the airport and related roads.
Airport, roads and nuclear power. I think we're noting the airport and roads and you're asking me about nuclear power. I'd probably find it easier to talk about airports and roads, or at least less controversial. However, the report that was released by the IPCC just this week, of course, did highlight their belief in terms of the need to shift to lower emissions intensity energy generation, and that nuclear plays a role there. And that's well appreciated and understood. And as a South Australian, in the home of Olympic Dam, Australia's largest and the world's largest deposit of uranium, I fully appreciate the significance of the industry and the opportunities it potentially presents. However, and I think this is correct, we've said as a party for some time, from our time in opposition and indeed predating that, that Australia will never really be able to have a sensible discussion about nuclear energy as long as one side of the major parties in Australia remains implacably opposed to any sense of development. We are willing to have the discussion. We know that it would be a difficult discussion, but happy to have the discussion if we had a willing partner in sensible discussions on the topic. But if all you have is an opposition that will play fear and run fear tactics on something that would take many terms of a government to realise, and that's the real reason, it's not the fear that we'd simply lose office, it is the fear that you'd have a debate where no investor is sensibly going to look at partnering with government on something where the risk profile, the sovereign risk as such, of government changing its policy direction is so great because you have an opposition that is so opposed to a sensible discussion in this space. Now, I think others, think of my former SA colleague Nick Minchin, who used to always be pretty keen in these discussions to equally highlight the economics of nuclear power, and that really in a country with such a wealth of resources as we have, not just uranium, but of course of coal and of natural gas, that it takes a lot for nuclear energy to stack up on the cost curve of energy generation as well. I think it's highly unlikely that we will see a discussion about nuclear energy for both of those reasons. But if the Labor Party suddenly had an epiphany in the next little while, well, we never know. Perhaps then a long and careful and cautious and sensible discussion in Australia could ensue that might lead to something a long way down the track.
Talking about a Labor epiphany, I mean, you're a South Australian, you'd know this much better than I would, but as I recall, Mike Rann started off as the leading opponent of uranium mining, and when he stepped down as Premier, he regarded uranium mining as his greatest achievement. So what was the story with the South Australian Labor Party on uranium mining?
Your recollection is very good there, Gerard. As a leading advisor to Don Dunstan, Mike Rann did indeed campaign against the establishment of the Olympic Dam mine, and the establishment of a uranium industry in Australia. Only by the time he was Premier and heading out the door to claim that the expansion of the Olympic Dam mine was one of his greatest achievements as Premier. Of course, that expansion has not actually been realised, and so the achievement is rather diminished in that regard. Look, I think in terms of the South Australian Labor Party, and in a sense, of course, the Federal Labor Party when it comes to uranium mining, in fairness, have been on a transformation, largely of course driven purely by the economics of it, and the fact that they, I guess, and I'm trying to think why they draw the limit here, but I imagine they draw the limit purely of course on the mining and extraction and exportation, because it is the very low risk end of the nuclear cycle, that once you move into processing to a higher level and of course ultimately utilisation in the energy process, and then a discussion, as we had a very long-winded one in this country, just about dealing with low-level waste, let alone the type of nuclear waste potentially coming from power facilities, they're all far riskier, for want of a better word, scenarios to deal with. And whilst we have at least applied an open mind to discussion, the Labor Party, I think, has limited itself in that regard, because it's been probably such a difficult journey just for them to get the left wing of their party to live with a complicated three mines policy for a period of time.
Question down the back.
Yeah,
Yes.
You've mentioned a one-stop shop for assessment. Is there also a one-stop shop for enforcement of the laws? If you're planning a department camera that goes around the country, or is it in each capital, or how do you enforce?
So the one-stop shop is a state-by-state arrangement in that sense. So we are devolving as such responsibility for Commonwealth assessments and approvals to the state and territory jurisdictions. Now, historically, there has been a level of state assessments already undertaken. So we already have a framework in place, and it's already allowed under the EPBC Act, the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, for states to undertake assessments on behalf of the Commonwealth and give approvals on behalf of the Commonwealth. No previous Commonwealth government, though, has fully utilised those powers under the Act. Some have allowed limited forms of assessments. We've been working through a process to expand the array of assessments that are allowed, and ultimately are working towards an arrangement where an approval by a state minister will be such that it is granted for state laws and federal laws as part of a uniform and seamless process. Now, the setting of conditions would then, of course, be the responsibility of that state minister under that system, and indeed it would be my expectation that the enforcement arrangements that ultimately come about would also be driven by the states, albeit if you reached a point where you had prosecutions of a breach under something that had occurred under federal law, then of course it would be a matter finally for federal authorities to execute those. But really what we are trying to do is say we have a bunch of environmental laws in this country that for major projects in particular, state and federal laws are triggered. Let's harmonise them into one process. We're not abolishing federal laws, we're harmonising them into one process that states will be responsible for administering.
Right, there's a question on the back of the car here, yes?
Yeah, Senator, thank you for taking the time to talk to us tonight. I noticed in the news in the last day or two an item where a commentator was publicly arguing that the failure to adequately and collectively address climate change will prove to be one of the greatest mistakes of human society. I was interested in your comments on that.
Look, I think there are a lot of doomsayers who assume that humanity is incapable of addressing this issue, perhaps because they perceive that that humanity or governments are not acting on the policies that they think are necessary to address this issue. Look, I think for the world to reduce its emissions profile, it will take technological breakthroughs. It doesn't really matter what type of policy you have in place. It will clearly take technological breakthroughs to achieve that. Now, I have confidence that we will see those technological breakthroughs, whether that is through greater carbon capture and reuse alongside existing energy generation facilities using fossil fuels like coal and gas, or whether it is because we have transformative leaps in the cost of generating renewable energy and the ability to use it around the clock and store it throughout the night when it may not be generating as much if it's solar or when it's not blowing as much if it's wind or any of those issues that some of those other technologies have. Whatever the leap is, and I can't tell you what that technological leap will be, but I have confidence that we will see those breakthroughs. And what our government, through pursuing the Emissions Reduction Fund, is seeking to do is, of course, provide the incentives for industry to invest in emissions abatement technology, and in do so, provide the potential that Australia might offer that technological breakthrough, that game changer as such. But it may well be that larger countries, and of course China and much of Asia, has an incentive to be able to effect change there, not just because of the global emissions debate. They have a very basic incentive of air quality in their cities. And so they are looking very closely at technologies to reduce emissions from power plants or emissions from vehicles and transportation, all, of course, in part to address basic living issues in major cities. So I'm quite confident and don't really accept the view of the doomsayers that we're destined to a terrible, terrible future. I believe that humanity has shown great ability over the years to face the problems presented to us, and that once again we will manage to do so through adaptive technology and the innovation and the things that have brought us to where we are today.
Senator Bergen, Sydney's second airport and developing Northern Australia, two huge concepts involving massive amount of infrastructure in many different ways. To what extent does the coalition see that those two projects as a fantastic opportunity to explore very far-reaching and innovative solutions in an environmentally friendly way, spread across all the infrastructure?
Okay. Quite a broad question, but I think the development of Sydney's second airport is a big task, but it's been looked at and studied and considered for so long, so very long, that it's probably a relatively simple task. Yes, of course, it's big, it's expensive, there's the question of getting the private finance that is necessary, but there's little doubt that it is of greater need to be delivered today than it was when it was first envisaged, not just months or years ago, but effectively decades ago, when people first started talking about it. Now, the transport solutions, I think, will be relatively straightforward for governments to finance, and I gather there will be, there were some details of that released today and more to come in the budget, and the airport itself is a relatively straightforward proposition. I think Northern Australia is the interesting one, and I gave one brief reference to Northern Australia in my comments, simply to flag that we have to make sure we apply the principles and learn the lessons of the past in relation to development of the north. Now, I was talking about water in that context, and that we have to make sure if we open up development of water resources in the north, that we don't do so in a way that sees us years down the track have to deal with some issue of over-allocation, and that we make sure we do the research in the first place to ensure that the water reserves we're talking about are being used in a sustainable way. Equally, that we make sure we do so in a market-driven way where the water has value and we make sure that it is used to the highest economic production capabilities. But there are a range of other issues we face in the north. There are, of course, labour issues. There are infrastructure and logistical issues. All of those are big considerations for how it occurs. And I think they will take innovative solutions. It will take significant investment, probably significant foreign investment, to be able to support development in some of those locations. But it is important, I think, to Australia's agricultural potential that we look to see what can be fully realised and achieved through northern development. But we will have to be nimble, we will have to be innovative. We don't go into looking at northern Australia with large dollops of money. There were big dollops of money committed to building airport roads today. The Northern Australia project is a slower and steadier one that is probably some years behind where Badgerys Creek is today.
Thank you. We're running out of time, we're very quick there. We'll be quick there and then a final question here. Yeah?
Okay. Senator, you mentioned the iconic lands administered by the Sydney Harbour Federation Trust, and you'd be aware of the proposal for a $36 million 6-bed aged care facility on Middle Head. Can you tell me whether you and the government think that it's appropriate to have a major commercial development such as that? It's different from anything else that's been developed in those iconic park areas. Do you think it's a reasonable...
Okay.
Commercial
development on Middle Head and Sydney Harbour.
And I also mentioned that the Sydney Harbour Federation Trust was innovative in self-funding now. And that was the innovation, in a sense, when it was established, to say we're going to take these lands, these old defence lands that are often in iconic locations but have old defence buildings on them, some of them heritage valued, some of them not, and we'll say to the Trust, here's a bit of a lump sum to try to clean things up. Beyond that, We want you to be a self-funding park system where you use the building infrastructure you've got to generate an income that then allows you to preserve and protect the other environmental features and assets you've got. And I think that is a very instructive and positive approach that was taken. But what that does mean is that the building infrastructure they've got, the built sites around Sydney Harbour, they need to have a look at how they can be appropriately optimised. Now, the commitment that I've given to communities in Middlehead is that we certainly will not be supporting any development that reduces public access to the space and the land there. But if a proposal comes forward that enhances the public space, provides greater access to people to enjoy the natural environment, and improves what is currently a pretty derelict site, well, then I think it is worthy of some positive consideration into the future.
Final question, quickly. Yeah.
Given the problem, Senator, with the Water Act, because it's based on the treaty's power, do we think that with the improved relations with the states that that issue can be opened up and addressed again?
Look, there's anything's possible, I guess, there, Jenny. I flagged that we'll be reviewing the Water Act relatively soon. I'm very conscious in reviewing the Water Act that I don't want to build expectations that means we're going to reconsider the sustainable diversion limits and go way back over the ground that's been very fraught and dangerous and difficult to travel and traverse to date. But I do want us to find efficiencies to reduce red and green tape that exists in the Water Act. And indeed, if we can simplify it because we have a more cooperative arrangement with the states, then that would be a positive outcome. And I'll look forward to getting your submission.
Many thanks. Well, look, there are other questions, but we're right on time, so I must conclude now. I've always been impressed by Senator Birmingham since I first saw him commented on Sky News, which he used to do quite frequently from Adelaide and other places. And tonight, as Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister for the Environment, Senator Birmingham's come along and given us a detailed talk and taken a lot of questions and responded to a lot of points of discussion. Being Parliamentary Secretary to Greg Hunt is a very important position. And tonight you've acquitted yourself very well. And I'd like to say well done tonight and good luck for the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.